Back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, middle of the month, October 15th, 2025, on Connecticut Today. I open the big Wednesday show looking at info being pieced together in connection with the death of a 12-year-old Connecticut girl. Will her death now result in calls for more homeschooling oversight? Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding of Brookfield weighed in on that case as well. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar looked at several big stories around the state while we were joined by CBS News military analyst, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, about the military and security aspects of the current and future situations in Gaza and the Middle East. Also, we welcome banking, real estate, and investment veteran Todd Sheets, the author of 2008, What Really Happened? Understanding the Great Financial Crisis. He also writes On Wealth and Progress, Balanced Commentary for a Better Future at Substack.com. All right, as we try and peel back the layers here, horrible, horrible story of this 12-year-old girl. And again, I don't sit here to pillory anybody. DCF, that's a tough, tough job. Police, child care workers, school workers. I mean, unfortunately, sadly, some of this stuff just unfortunately falls through the cracks here. And I think now in memory of this 12-year-old girl found in New Britain, with officials saying she's been dead, they don't know how many months, late fall of 2024, earlier this year, they're not sure. They're trying to figure that out. I guess they'll check the decomposition of the body, but at least in memory of her, something's got to be investigated here. And again, I know people that have worked for DCF. I've talked to DCF clients on my show. I remember a couple of years ago when I first started here at WICC, I remember taking a call, interestingly, from a young man who said he was a Waterbury teen and he wanted to see his DCF worker more. He liked her. He only got to see her like once every 5 or 6 weeks. But again, we got to figure out what went on here. Now, according to this story that was just posted a couple of hours ago, the DCF says it has, and this is in the Connecticut Mirror, through their cooperation with Connecticut Public Broadcasting, I guess, DCF is now going to review its involvement with the family of a 12-year-old girl whose remains were found last week in New Britain. The commissioner is saying they're going to look in to see what happened with the monitoring of Jacqueline Mimi Torres Garcia and her three caregivers, of course, that being the little girl's mother, her aunt, her mother's sister, and the boyfriend there. New Britain Mayor Aaron Stewart saying yesterday the agency had previously been involved with the girl's family. They're not being specific about that, though. Torres Garcia attended New Britain Public Schools from kindergarten through the fifth grade. Her mother withdrew Torres from the school system in late August of 2024 on the first day of sixth grade. She gave a new address for the family in the town of Farmington. That's according to the New Britain School District. Now, the girl's mother filed a notice on the same day saying Torres Garcia would get instruction at home. So on that day, she filed a paperwork or whatever it is. I saw it online, whatever it is, and what you have to fill out and what you have to tell the state and what your lesson plan is going to be or whatever, that, hey, it's going to be homeschooling. She was never reported missing. Police in New Britain found her body this past October 8th, 2025, inside a storage bin. Investigators think Torres Garcia likely died in the fall of 2024. That's according to Farmington police. Preliminary investigation of the remains showed severe malnourishment. Now, again, the mother and the mother's boyfriend have been charged with her murder. An aunt also charged with unlawful restraint. That's the aunt we're talking about. Risk of injury. Oh, intentional cruelty to a person under 19 years old. And again, the aunt here, right around the time the girl went missing, according to the reporting that I read earlier in Channel 3, is this is a very convoluted story. The aunt here, Jacqueline Garcia, she had been apparently investigated and prosecuted on a previous case stemming from 2022. She was sentenced to 10 years in jail this past December, which may have been around the time that the 12-year-old girl's body was callously put in this container. But again, even then, there's a question of, well, why was the aunt only ordered to serve 18 months in prison when she herself, according to this, was being investigated for a case that stemmed back to, I believe, 2022. Yeah, in February of 2022, police started investigating the aunt after she brought her then 11-month-old to the hospital for a broken leg. Oh, my God. What a horrible ring of events here. My God. So, again, look. Like I said, there's two sides of the fork here, and they both have to be looked at. And I know, look, I have nothing against homeschooling kids. I really don't. I know parents and guardians and moms and dads and domestic partners who have homeschooled their kids and they love it and the kids are incredibly well behaved and they're two or three grade levels ahead of what you see happening in the regular schools here. But again, from what I understand, unless there's a DCF concern here, I guess there's no check-in procedure here if a student is being homeschooled. What's wrong with that? Seriously, and would it have prevented this? Who knows? Maybe yes, maybe no. Would a stronger sort of involvement in the Waterbury case, that alleged home imprisonment case, and I guess the stepmother in that case, she was in court last week. It's coming up again in a few weeks. You know, you can't guarantee anything. Obviously, you can't. But the more sets of eyes you have on something, with the proviso of, hey, you're just doing a cursory check up and down. What's the house look like? Does the kid look happy? Any bruises there? Whatever. That's it. You're not going to comment on what mom and dad are teaching. That's for somebody else to go over. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with stepping up and just saying, hey, if the kids are going to be homeschooled, we're not going to let the state get involved in what you teach them. We're not going to let the state say, hey, you've got to tell them, you know, there are 37 genders and you have to have drag time, story time in your living room. I'm not saying that. But here you have a couple of cases where could more oversight have been good? Yeah. And again, in this case, there was previous DCF oversight. And believe me, being a DCF caseworker ain't easy. I've talked to some of them. It's not easy, and they're dealing with hundreds, 200-300 sometimes, DCF. So what do you think? And again, hear me out here. Should the state conduct more safety check-ins for kids who are said to be homeschooled? Now, obviously, the three people involved here, the mother and the boyfriend, have the harshest charges here. The aunt here, who was in jail previously or was being investigated for 2 years, the lesser charges. This is a badly convoluted case. But I think we have to be careful here if we just pick up. You've got to relax here and say, okay, what might the state suggest here, or how can we prevent this from happening? Because you know what? there aren't enough DCF workers to check in on every kid and do it every day and do it ad infinitum. Now, again, this 12-year-old girl who whose remains were found a short time ago. Now, nobody's really sure when she died, when she passed away. Three people facing serious charges here, two of them worse charges than the other. And look, we're not here to blame DCF or to blame caseworkers, but how could this thing be tightened up? You know what I mean? If we're going to look at this and we're going to take a fresh view of this, how can this be? And I know no system is ever, there's no perfect system for this, but DCF admits they did have involvement with this family. And apparently now the aunt here, who was facing the lesser charges of the three, was already being investigated for a wounds to an 11-month-old back in 2022. Just a horrid situation here. Let's go to Ann in Milford. Ann, good afternoon. How are you?
Oh, hi there. I hope I'm on the right thing. I'm on my phone and talking to you.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, you're on the air. Okay, do you want to be on the air?
Yes, I just didn't know if I was like doing the wrong thing.
No, and you passed the test so far, so you're doing great.
Yes. Okay. Do I get a free trip somewhere?
Yeah. I'll have to check with the front office on that. But go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm calling about what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I've been a teacher.
Okay.
I homeschooled my daughter for a little while, in this state.
Yep.
Lots of regulations.
Yep.
And been in the school industry. And I think going down the path of if someone is homeschooled, someone needs to check on them is a dangerous slippery slope. What's happened to this girl is horrible.
Yeah.
But you've got a relative who's a little 11-month-old was abused.
Yep.
You've got all the stuff going on. I know that the children's services have way too many caseloads. I get that. But there are relatives. There are neighbors. There are people. No one's speaking up and saying anything. But to go with homeschooling, like you said, Jersey, they take your kids away if you're not going to do pronouns and gender or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, can I tell you a funny little story?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So it's like a little parable.
Okay.
So if the little girl asks her mom, why is it that when we make a holiday roast, we always cut the ends off the roast and put it in the pan and bake it?
Okay.
Like, I don't know. Let's ask grandma.
Okay.
So she goes to grandma and says, why do we always cut off the ends when we make a roast?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, well, when I was a little girl, we had a really tiny stove and the roast didn't fit.
Okay.
So you start by insisting that children's services or the police check up on homeschoolers.
Yeah.
And it might take a while, but eventually they're going to forget why they're doing it.
No, okay. I get your point. Yeah. It just, I understand where that parable was. I got it. All right.
And that happened in California, which is where I homeschooled.
Okay.
And this is quite a long time ago, but it was like, you must be doing something evil in your home.
Yeah, no, and I do have to run. Thank you for the story there. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ann. Look. I am not into, and she's right, and I brought that up before. You've got some states now who are lashing back at homeschoolers, you know, with the prodding of the teachers' unions and the school unions, saying, no, you must not allow this. We must indoctrinate your kids. And I think that bill that said that you got to do gender studies, thankfully, I think it was defeated in Michigan and I think in Pennsylvania, but they're still pushing it in Jersey there. God, I hope Chitterelli wins. I don't think he will, though. Todd in Shelton is here. Hey, Todd, how are you?
Hiya, Mr. Pastelli. You're doing a phenomenal job.
Thank you, Todd. What's up, buddy?
They need to bring back the truant officers. Remember the little rascals? The truant officer would go after them and they get their dog Petey to bite his leg because he'd always be checking up on the little kids. They got to go to school.
God, the truant officers. Todd, thank you.
They got to be accountable for every kid.
That's right. Todd, thanks. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, my friend. We've spent a good portion of today's program talking about more and more details coming out around this. It's just horrible death. There's no other way you can talk about this. A 12-year-old Jacqueline Torres Garcia said to have been pulled out with the excuse that she was being homeschooled. They didn't see her past late August of 2024. They found the body about a week and change ago. After the family had moved, the theory now is she actually passed away maybe late 2024 toward the end of the year. It's taken this time toward the until they found the body. This was involving her mother, her boyfriend there, and the aunt, the sister of the mother here. All three had had previous criminal cases. The aunt was being involved in a case stemming back to 2022. Just a horrible situation here. Couple questions I had here, and one of them has to do with the bubbling sentiment already about maybe targeting homeschoolers here. And in fact, I put that question up here today. You know, DCF is overworked. How do we make sure this doesn't happen under the guise of, well, he or she is being homeschooled, they're fine? I'm sure the General Assembly will look at this. State Senate Republican Leader Steve Harding joining us. Steve, good afternoon. Good to have you here, Steve. It's a horrible question here, and I would imagine you guys and gals on both sides of the aisle, you're going to talk to the Child Advocacy Office about this and DCF, I would think, right?
We have to, because again, these type of tragic incidents and disgusting incidents that we're seeing here can never happen again. And if there's a way that we can address this legislatively in a reasonable manner that's actually targeted at the heart of what led to this tragedy, mm-hmm. as opposed to political efforts, like some individuals unfortunately are immediately looked at in the wake of the terrible tragedy, which is wrong as well. But no, if there's a way we can tackle this and get oversight over the entities that are supposed to be in charge of protecting our children in the state, then it's incumbent upon us as legislators to do the right thing and implement policies and regulations and oversight that will ensure that our entities are being held accountable and that the children, our most precious resource in the state, are being protected in incidents like we see here never occurs again. It's even sadder when you consider that, you know, we see what that, you know, the man that, you know, was a young man or a child at first and later became a grown-up, unfortunately, that was being essentially tortured in his own basement by his stepmother for years and years and years. You hear about that tragedy, and then in the wake of that, we're now hearing of what just happened to this young lady, and it's just we have a problem here, and we got to get a handle on it and handle on it now, because literally – kids are being tortured and held captive, and in this case, unfortunately, children are losing their life.
And Steve, the tendency from some people is to immediately point the finger at Child Protective Services and DCF.
Right.
Yeah, Steve, they you and I both know, they only have so many people, and those people are so burdened and overburdened. I don't know what each worker has now, but I remember being told by somebody it was 200 or 300 different clients. I mean, you could double or triple the staffing, and it may not be enough for DCF.
You would hope that if we invested what was necessary in those areas that we'd see an improvement and it could prevent something like this. I mean, but this is, I mean, I will say this. I have no doubt that there's many, many DCF employees, those that work for child advocacy in the state that put in incredible hours, mm-hmm. incredible work, do the best they can, truly care about the children they're tasked with protecting. But at the same time, there's something that is wrong within the system when something like this happens. There's just no excuse for it. Even if, unfortunately, we are overburdened in that area, that we need to be vocal about it And those that are in charge or in management that have the ability to speak with government officials, there needs to be a clear communication that, hey, there is dire need for more resources here. Otherwise, things like this are going to slip through the cracks. And, you know, we have heard blanketly that, you know, that resources are needed. But, I mean, I haven't heard it to the level, you know, frankly, that you should be hearing it when, when you see cases like this. There's no excuse for this, Paul. I mean, that's the thing. This is you know, somebody that should have been on the radar of DCF, of Protective Services, and it's inexcusable that they weren't, and then something like this could happen. At the very least, well, we have to investigate what occurred here and ensure that we can remedy it going forward.
Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding. Steve, thanks. Keep in touch on this, and we appreciate the time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. All righty, about that time every week, quarter after five or so. You can't really set your watch by it because I'm off by a minute or two, but you can kind of sort of set your watch or your sundial by it. Our weekly check-in with Hearst Connecticut Media senior columnist and editor Dan Haar, who has a cornucopia, a veritable a dinner table of stuff this week. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
You know, it's a busy mid-fall week.
Yeah.
You know, this is the summer. It was summer weather last week, but the summer doldrums are far behind us.
Yeah, my kind of weather, too. Nice little snap in the air, Dan, crisp. And speaking of snap, I think let's segue this way, huh? Governor Ned Lamont has a little hop in his step, wondering, hey, come on up to Connecticut if you don't like Zohran Mamdani. What's up with that?
Oh, when you said speaking of snap, I thought you were talking about the food aid.
No,
which is also on the, talking on the a little table as an issue.
Yeah, hop in the foot there. The governor says, "Hey, Dan, you know, we'll serve you up here in the state."
Yeah, no, the governor is actually, in contrast to his usual stance on things, he is not eager to see New Yorkers flock to Connecticut to avoid a faltering New York that results from a democratic socialist or a social democrat, as they say in France, being elected. That's not what he wants. He's fearful that New York will not do as well as had hoped if Mamdani is elected. But he's saying to me, no, we don't want to see that. We want New York to do well because it's a double-edged sword, remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got... If New York's finance sector does not do well, and by the way, the governor was falsely quoted saying that Wall Street might collapse or crash, That's not what he said. What he said and what he meant was that he's afraid that the sector will not feel wanted and will not be nurtured by this mayor who doesn't love the Wall Street sector and may move elsewhere. And elsewhere could mean Connecticut.
There you go.
But it also could mean, as we've already seen with J.P. Morgan, it could also mean Texas.
Yeah.
And we don't want to see that. So it's a double-edged sword, and the governor is not zealously looking for Connecticut to benefit. That was my idea.
Oh.
I was the one who wrote that Connecticut could benefit if there's a faltering in New York. But the governor is more, pragmatic about that.
How about a branch of the NYSE, Dan, like in Cos Cob in Greenwich? That would go well, don't you think, with zoning and everything? Might that work?
Well, we already had the world's largest trading floor in Stanford.
And that's
back
right.
When Swiss Bank and later UBS had it, that was the single largest trading floor. So, you know. Why can't that be converted back into a stock exchange? It absolutely can.
Absolutely.
The Stanford Exchange.
Absolutely. The blue state view of what, albeit, is off to a bit of a rocky start in the Middle East with peace, and I know you wrote a piece on that. I read it the other day.
The blue state view of
The Trump piece. Yeah, the Trump peace plan.
Is very complicated.
Yeah.
Because you want to applaud peace, and you do. And you want to applaud the hostages coming home, those that did, the last 20 remaining living hostages, you do. And you want to applaud the framework for the beginning of talking about a true settlement. And you want to applaud the person who brought all this about, making it more difficult is that the person who brought it all about is A, exaggerating the importance, meaning, and difficulty of what he did, and B, trashing the people who set the stage for making it happen, i.e. Antony Blinken, the former Secretary of State, and his boss, former President Biden. And so given that hyper-political situation, the Democrats are okay saying, good that it's here, it's not fast enough, it's not enough, and we move on. We hope for a true breakthrough. And so it's not quite as difficult as it seems when you look at the picture.
Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media, senior editor and columnist, joining us with a few more things to go over here. I like the way you put this. The subpoena battle fell in the favor of Ned Lamont. So I guess, Dan, we're not going to see the governor testify in my kind of trial. I've been saying that on the air, Dan. Anytime we can have a trial with envelopes full of cash exchanged in men's rooms and over coffee, that's my kind of trial. I like that. I don't know about you, but I like that.
And plus, Dunkin' Donuts came up in the trial because it was in the Dunkin' Donuts that we know and love on Capitol Avenue, right near the former office of said former state official, now on federal 22 federal charges, that he would receive money, allegedly would receive money, according to testimony, under a newspaper in said Dunkin' Donuts, not to mention Capitol Grill. So yes, but getting back to Lamont, all along we were wondering, why is that relevant, right? Because there are all kinds of bad things that could have happened to Lamont's to his legacy and his reputation, had people been allowed to say whatever they want, none of which would have been relevant to the simple fact of the bribery charges. And that won the day, and Judge Underhill did decide that way. And actually, it wasn't a ruling by the judge so much as it was a discussion that led to Norm Pattis and other defense attorneys simply taking the governor's name off the subpoena list.
Now look, I'm certainly not, the trial is going on, obviously, while I'm on. It's too bad it's not on CTN or any other outlet. But, Dan, is the sense here that the purpose of the defense coming up, do you think it's just to try and maybe melt off years off of whatever sentence Diamantis is going to get? I mean, he's in deep here, right? There's no way he escapes from this, does he?
Well, he hasn't even presented his case yet. Let's see what he says. I mean, all trials look bad after the prosecution is done and before the defense presents its case.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's going to say. I mean, certainly it looks bad.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I don't even know if it's legitimate to use trials as a sort of a way of mitigating your guilt. I think you're supposed to try and prove your innocence or prove your lack of guilt. But I don't. Look, it looks bad, but he's a persuasive guy, and he has the next 3 days to persuade the jury.
And, of course, he's got Norm Pattis with him, too, so that'll be interesting. Couple of more things here with our buddy, our pal Dan Harr from Hearst Connecticut Media. Boy, Dan, this case now that's brought back the specter of what DCF knew and when did they know it, and the involvement with the very, at least on the face, very disturbing details of a family here and this 12-year-old girl. Just a horrible case here.
It's terrible, and it may be the worst of all the cases we've seen because it involves a killing and the storing of a body and all this horrible stuff. And we know that DCF had contact with the family. What we don't know is, what precisely it was. Our hearts remain with those impacted by Jacqueline's tragic and shocking death, said DCF Interim Commissioner Susan Hamilton.
Yeah.
It's still not entirely clear what DCF's involvement is, but it looks, on the outside, it looks like some of these other cases that we had, for example, the one in Waterbury, the captivity case. Six times they came around and said, hey, what's going on with S, the person who is known as S?
Yeah.
and what's going on. And six times they went away saying, okay, we're satisfied. And the same thing with the alleged serial rape case that I wrote about involving the young woman from Bristol. You know, three times DCF came around and said, what's going on? And three times they went away satisfied. And this is obviously not okay.
Yeah.
The only countervailing point you can make is that there are people who believe that DCF is acting too aggressively in their cases. I've investigated a couple of those types of cases over the years in which DCF took away a child who, according to family and some evidence, looked like they shouldn't have done it and shouldn't have acted that aggressively. So it's extraordinarily difficult circumstances anytime DCF gets involved in any case. And when it's this extreme, you have to look very, very closely. I think there are state statutes that can change. There are some circumstances, including one case that I wrote about involving the teacher this past year who was been arrested four times for improperly touching students. That's a matter of state statute. That's how state statutes are written.
Yep.
In part. So some of it is stuff that can be fixed and some of it is not.
And we'll see what happens with there. And finally, Dan, again, you and I, I'm fascinated by this first district congressional race and the longtime incumbent there, John Larson and Luke Bronin. And I guess there's a battle of the bucks here. Now, what did we see? Has it changed? Mr. Bronin had a slight lead over Larson. What's the latest with that?
Today was the filing deadline, and file they did.
Yeah.
Some of this we talked about and had been reported previously. Bronin, during the quarter ending September 30th, the 3 months, which was, of course, was the first 3 months he was active, raised $1.19 million.
Yeah.
He, of course, is now up over $1.2 million, needless to say.
Okay.
And their target is over $2 million. And it's high-stakes stuff. Larson raised $800,000. But remember, Larson has already given away money prior to this quarter before he knew he had an opponent.
Yeah.
He was raising money and quickly giving it to his colleagues in the U.S. House that are in red districts, that in swing districts, where they hope to hold their seats.
Yeah.
So he is now – he told me on Saturday when as you may know, Chris Murphy endorsed him in Hartford on Saturday.
Yep.
Or maybe it was Sunday. Was it Sunday?
It was on the weekend. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was, and it was three blocks from my house, so I rode my bike there. But in any case, at that event, Larson did tell me that he raised more money than he would have. So in other words, he's not just raising his usual amount.
Okay.
So you're going to see the stepping up by Larson, and when an incumbent who is willing to take PAC money steps up his fundraising, you can reasonably expect that he's going to beat a non-incumbent, however well-known Luke Bronin is, who's not taking PAC money. So there isn't a problem with Larson raising money. The issue here is the third candidate in the race, the third of five candidates, is Jillian Gilchrist from the first, from the House, the 18th district, where I live. And she only raised $54,000, which leads you to say she's dead in the water. But her answer is, I didn't want to spend the first few weeks of my campaign raising money. When the time comes to raise money, I'll raise it. But those numbers make her candidacy look non-viable on the face of it.
Absolutely. Great stuff as usual. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, thank you. Have a great weekend. And we'll chat next week, sir. Thank you.
We will indeed.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate that. The evolving situation with the Middle East peace plan, Gaza, Israel, and all that. And joining us right now, as always, we enjoy having CBS News military analyst and retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland with us. Colonel, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing well, and I hope you are also.
Thank you, Colonel. Appreciate that. Well, now all the diplomats are glad-handing themselves, Colonel, and signing all the documents and posing for pictures. But the security aspect of what's going on right now in Gaza with the Israeli forces there, what might happen in the future, looks like Hamas is not laying down all their arms. What are you hearing from your contacts, and how complicated is this going to be moving forward?
Well, it's enormously complicated, Paul. We need to understand what we have, what we don't have. we have a ceasefire, an end of hostilities, at least temporarily. We've had an exchange of prisoners for hostages, and we're all very hopeful about the release of 20 living Israeli hostages and hopefully the release of the remains of 28 others. In return, of course, the Israelis have released about nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners who were held in Israeli prisons, many for life sentences for crimes preceding the actual hostilities, mm-hmm. beginning on the 7th of October in 23. And then about 1,500 Gazans who were detained during the conflict. And also we have the expansion of humanitarian assistance flowing into the 2 million people in Gaza who are suffering enormous deprivation. But we don't have a peace settlement as such, and you're right, the key step now will be the negotiations for the disarmament of Hamas. But I think that's going to be really difficult for Hamas to do. And in past, they have said that's basically a red line for them. And all of a sudden, we've already seen indicators of the difficulty of that. Hamas still controls a significant percentage of the Gaza Strip. The Israelis have pulled back to agreed mm-hmm. lines. And in the last couple of days, we've had reports of the execution of people on the streets by Hamas fighters for collusion with the Israelis. We've had reports of fighting between Hamas and other groups, Islamic Jihad, clans, etc., and some exchange of fire between small groups of Hamas fighters who were approaching Israeli lines. So a very tenuous situation at the moment. Hopefully that negotiation will be completed and Hamas can be disarmed so we can move on then to governance issues and reconstruction.
And Colonel, finally, I guess what, there's a small amount of U.S. forces either in the area or being distributed throughout the area. What is that true or not? And what's their role going to be?
Well, there's about 200 U.S. troops, as I understand it, that are in Israel. Now, we've had U.S. troops in Israel prior to this. A lot of it was to enhance Israeli air defense, mm-hmm. provide Israel, particularly intelligence, during the conflict with Hezbollah and with Iran. And so these 200 folks, I would imagine, are what I would call enablers, communications, command and control, intelligence gathering, logistics, this monumental task that I mentioned a moment before of providing humanitarian assistance now for 2 million people who are living in absolute desolation. Everything has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. There's no running water. There's no medical supply. There's no food. And they've got to establish now that humanitarian assistance that's going to sustain that population for an indefinite period of time, because, Paul, it's going to take months, if not years,
oh, yeah.
to see any kind of reconstruction in Gaza.
CBS News military analyst, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, as always, thank you for your insight. We appreciate it, sir. Take care.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, appreciate it. There you go. U.S. Army retired Lieutenant Colonel Jeff McCausland. There. Well, a lot of you people in my listening area here and the entire station, you have connections to New York City in and out of the Big Apple. Maybe every day of the week, Monday through Friday, maybe as I used to, pre-COVID, 2 or 3 days a week, or you're just interested in what's going on in the Big Apple. And nationally, people are watching that race between a self-described Democratic Socialist, Zohran Mamdani, who's going to fix everything with about $10 billion he doesn't have. Joining us right now is banking, real estate, and investment veteran Todd Sheets. He's the author of 2008, What Really Happened, Understanding the Great Financial Crisis. He also writes on Wealth and Progress, Balanced Commentary for a Better Future. You can catch that at Substack.com. And he has some thoughts here about Todd, I don't know, you tell me, the appeal of socialism. What's going on here? Todd, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me today.
The Mamdani socialists, like, I know a lot of young, like, my son lives in New York and his friends, and they make all pretty good money, and they think the guy is cool. Like, explain this to me, Todd. I don't quite get it.
You know, well, I think a huge amount of what's happening, my understanding is a significant amount of Mamdani support is coming from young college-educated people.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, leads us to the fact that there's been a great deal of miseducation within the educational system that has, you know, probably grown worse over time over the last 20 to 25 years. And mm-hmm. what's kind of happened is instead of being taught that capitalism is the solution,
yeah,
they've been taught that capitalism is the problem and socialism is the solution, which basically runs contrary you know, to the reality of what has happened, you know, in this country historically and almost everywhere else around the world, both historically and today.
I love those young voters, Todd, and you've probably seen this. It's a great social media meme, you know, kill capitalism, flip the switch. And those stickers, those anti-capitalism stickers, are on their $2,000 Apple laptop as they sit there and sip a $9 latte with their $100 jeans. I mean, I don't make this make sense, Todd. I don't know. I'm stumped here.
Yeah, well, let's go back. I mean, you mentioned the book about the housing crisis,
yeah,
the bubble, the collapse, the financial crisis. I think that's where a lot of this comes from. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about this. Many of those people who, you know, maybe they were activists, or they were in school, they saw, you know, the collapse in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Then what followed was the Occupy Wall Street movement that energized many young people to come out and protest against a Wall Street that they saw getting bailed out, while they saw, you know, many other people who, you know, weren't large corporations, were working class people losing their homes, losing their jobs and that kind of thing. And it, within the schools, I think they were taught to blame it on Wall Street. And Wall Street certainly played a role in this. I'm not here,
sure,
to deny that. But as I show in the book, you know, the sequence of events here is there was about a 100-year period of time where the housing markets in this country worked incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
They were a way for young families to buy in, to start to build some wealth. They provided a forced savings program and an avenue to the American dream.
Yeah.
That lasted up through 1998. And then in 1998, what happened was we had two government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
mm-hmm,
both of whom had become so large that they were effectively the 800-pound gorillas in the housing market, and they had, for the first time in history, the ability to move something as large as the U.S. housing market based on their own actions. Their growth rates doubled in 98, which was when housing prices first took off.
Mm.
And then in the 2000s, the Fed pushed interest rates down to historic lows as a response to the collapse of the tech stock bubble, which only added further fuel to the fire. And so, you know, the real problems that led to the bubble, the collapse, the great financial crisis and the great recession were these government interventions,
mm-hmm,
first in the form of the government sponsored enterprises and then in the form of the Federal Reserve's interest rate policies. But the message that everybody took away was, oh, this was, you know, Wall Street greed run amok, which that did happen. But you have to say, well, why then? Why not 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, 30 years earlier, you know, throughout this 100-year history where it all worked so well? And the reason is because these two elements of government intervention, you know, played such an overwhelming force in driving this unique bubble.
And you've got guys like Mondami out there who see an opening, right, Todd, and say, well, hey, I'm going to make everything, you know, rent freeze and this, and the rent's too high in New York. And I'm like, well, yeah, it is. My son has paid some outlandish rents. He's in a better spot now. But how is socialism going to help that? I don't think it will. I might be wrong. You tell me.
No, it's going to make it worse. I mean, to me, this goes back to, you know, we can look at this from two perspectives. You know, in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, government's not the solution, it's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to get government out of the economy. That helped kick off a 20-year boom of prosperity that started in the Reagan years and lasted through the Clinton years, who also signed on to that belief system. But since then, we've gone back in the other direction, where the idea is government is the solution to these things instead of the problem. And this is just the most recent version of that, which is that, you know, instead of admitting the failures and the real causes of these problems, it's like, well, these things happened, they've caused these problems, and now we need some different government solutions to fix the problems that they blame on capitalism, but which were really a function of socialistic mistakes that the system has been making for the last 20-some years.
The name of the book, 2008, What Really Happened, Understanding the Great Financial Crisis. Also, our guest writes On Wealth and Progress, Balanced Commentary for a Better Future. Check that out at Substack.com. Todd Sheets has been the guest. Todd, thank you. Appreciate the time. Continued good luck, and I'm sure we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me, Paul. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Todd.